I am six. The 29th of April, 1959 to the 28th of April, 1960. Over. 17 Number Ones by Stuart Nolan. It was April 1959. I was a newly six-year-old boy living in Newton Stewart in Scotland. We had lived elsewhere in the world due to my father's role, but I didn't remember much of this previous life, which sticks with me to this day. I was surrounded by the rugged beauty of the Scottish countryside. The rolling hills and the sparkling rivers were always a source of inspiration for me as a young boy. Being a young boy, I had to learn to be independent early on. I spent most of my childhood playing outside, exploring the wilderness and discovering new things. The vast open fields and dense forests were my playground, and I would often get lost in my own imagination, pretending to be a brave explorer, discovering new lands. I remember playing in the streets, sometimes closer to the banks of the river. We were proud of our town and our county. It was a small town, built on textiles, but with a soft heart built on fish. It was around this time that more resilient and enduring memories started to form, particularly songs of the time. Home recording wasn't quite ready for widespread consumption, so you could only hear music through the purchase of records or on the radio. And if something was popular, the best place to hear it was on radio, fleetingly random, on the airwaves or on the BBC Light programme. But at six, I wasn't often allowed to stay up past 7 p.m. for Pick of the Pops, even if it was Saturday night. My father, in his role as the minister for the Church of Scotland, didn't care for popular music of the time, but I could only hear snippets of the popular songs through the window and the walls, depending on whether or not my neighbours were having a night in or at the dance. The number one songs just around the time of my birthday was It Doesn't Matter Anymore by Buddy Holly. I remember hearing it on the radio and singing along to the catchy tune. My friends and I would often play pretend concerts in the backyard, pretending to be rock and roll stars like Buddy Holly. I didn't know what it was that didn't matter, but Buddy reassured me that it didn't. Not anymore. The next big song to reach the coveted number one position was A Fool Such As I by Elvis Presley. Everyone was a fan of Elvis, and his records were hard to avoid on the radio. I remember dancing around the living room to this song, pretending to be as cool and suave as Elvis himself. I didn't understand why Elvis was a fool, but he made it sound sincere. Roulette by Russ Conway was another tune that was popular during this year. I enjoyed the catchy melody. My parents were always careful to monitor what music we listened to, but they didn't mind me listening to this one. The instrumental piano was catchy in a way that was hard to forget. I remember my mother humming along to Dream Lover by Bobby Darin as she went about her household chores. During its tenure in the charts, it was frequently played on the radio. It was a romantic song that always seemed to put her in a good mood. I didn't really understand Living Doll. It seemed an old wish. It made me think of Frankenstein and his monster. Cliff in the Shadows making a serious mistake by wanting a zombie. Only 16 by Sam Cooke was a song that I remember singing along to the lyrics and trying to mimic Sam Cooke's soulful voice. It was a song that always seemed to lift my spirits. Only six I would sing. Here Comes the Summer by Jerry Keller was a song that always seemed to brighten everyone's mood. It was a cheerful, upbeat tune that was perfect for the warm summer days, just as they started to fade into September. although the motive of schools out was mostly lost on me, as I would have just gotten ready to start attending school around now. Mac the Knife by Bobby Darin hit the top of the chart soon afterwards, a song I've always been fascinated with. The knife allegory is something that stuck with me, the one-armed scissor. Travelling Light by Cliff Richard and the Shadows was next to hit number one. At least this time, Cliff's wishes seemed to make more sense. Maybe he was escaping from his previously desired monster. What Do You Want was the next pick of the pops this year. And then it was What Do You Want to Make Those Eyes at Me For by Emil Ford and the Checkmates. And then Anthony Newley, Why, was the next, but awfully sweet. Sorry, thoughts leaping around my head. A running bear. He couldn't swim the raging river because the river was too wide. And then it was My Old Man's a Dustman. The refrain and concept of Cor Blimey Trousers is stuck in my memory of this time. My old man was anything but a dustman, though. He had no Cor Blimey Trousers or hobnail boots. And we weren't in a council flat. The Church of Scotland ensured we had adequate accommodation. Nothing extravagant. Just before turning 7, the last number one of my year was again Anthony Newley. A slightly creepy request for permission. So then, if I say I love you, do you mind? Make an idol of you, do you mind? 17 different number one songs over the course of this year. It's a comfortable, familiar number, but I wasn't to know why at this young age.
Under You Got My Life by India Goldsmith.
I'm here in my head, and year and here wet me in the gloom, where I lie looking at the ceiling and at wee little Charlie boy peeping in his mirror at me, peeping at him inside his wee little cage. I dunno ken how or why, but this year is gonna be a crucial one in my development into a human being. Given what the Jesuits say about giving them a boy until he's 7 and all, given I'm 6 just now, but in talking to myself, I'm going to be talking to you in the future. So I may as well make things a little clearer.
This year's going to turn out to be vital, because by considering my present and imagining the future via my self-reflective faculties, my awareness of my internal, mostly undeliberate thinking, which is the only real essence of what could be considered my lasting, self-persisting over time, and the primary part of that nebulous me permanently affixed to the wellspring of my subconscious, which, being subconscious, I cannot ever really have access to, and can only really reflect on the upwellings of, which stream into my 6 or 16 or 70-year-old mind in an endless fashion, forming the many thoughts that are acted on by me about half of the time. I see that being sickly, cooped up, poorly and ill for a huge swathe of my 6th year, it's been about 3 months in bed, but for a 6-year-old that's as good as forever while it's happening, is altering a part of my psyche for good, a psychic switch flicking that'll permanently fixate it upon making the most of any and all future opportunities to be noisily out in the world, regarding any limitations or boxing in or defining by others or even being unappreciated and unregarded to be the most egregious crimes that can be done to me and my ego once the impact of my temporary predicament matures into a long-term neurosis that will likely be as much a source of strength as it is a defect of character. Indeed, this crucial time, where I can't noisily show off or performatively demonstrate who I am to get oodles by way of return of the crucial attention that is the fuel for the fire burning inside every child, turns out to fix my psyche toward getting this attention in a way that will not ever waver, and its demands will become increasingly hard to satiate, until I realize at a distant point in the future that such an insatiable thirst for recognition is what's been driving my work, and I attempt to burn it out of myself and move on. I'm not deprived at home, though. I'm loved and adored, even though I'm not sure I know it. I'm cared for, fed, watered, clothed, schooled, and I listen to the sounds of the BBC Light and Third programmes percolating, muffled, up the stairs, through my bedroom door, and wonder how the talking people get into the radio, and how the songs can be played over and over, exactly the same every time they repeat, as I toss and turn with boredom on my small single mattress, resting on its creaky wooden frame. I get out of bed a few times a day to poke my fingers into the cage of Charlie Boy, the budgie Mum got me to keep me company while I'm recuperating from the string of illnesses which the doctor said were nothing to worry about. I just needed to rest. I mush the white chalky honeycomb of Charlie Boy's cuttle bone between the bars and wiggle the strings of golden seeds to try and get the wee guy to peck. But he always just backs off or drops a tiny white-black pellet onto his sandpaper until I leave him alone and he eventually gets on with nibbling under his own steam in his own time. He comes out to fly around the room once or twice a week, but he always has to be locked inside again, which seems normal because there are no budgies flying around in the outside world, so that must be what budgies need. Charlie Boy and I are two beings in the same predicament, caged, unable to spread our wings and fly, either in the literal sense, him, or the metaphorical, me. Charlie Boy and I will spend the next decade together until I'm 16, when I find Charlie lying feet skyward on the floor of his metal home, the event that I might later realize signals the end of my childhood and becomes the cue for me to burst forth into the world, ready to find what it is out there that fate has contrived for me to do, because my most loyal childhood companion will be dead, and will thus need replacing. Another thing that happens this year is that my intellect and smarts begin to bloom and balloon. With nobody else around, Charlie Boy is the only person I can have a conversation with, and although his beak rarely moves, we have long chats about our enclosure, where I don't even realize I am doing the talking and thinking for both of us, a dynamic that will likely continue throughout almost all of my relationships from this point on. Knowing I'm always the smartest person in the room gets pretty fixed now, too, because it's necessarily true for 3 whole months on end, and seems to persist even when I'm in adult company, given grown-ups always have to keep dealing with the trifling things in front of them, like getting the bills paid, whereas I'm free to create and imagine and explore a whole universe of which I am the master, where I can do whatever I feel like, with my preening, scruffy little sidekick for company. Another continuing life script that, when combined with that dynamic mentioned formerly, will undoubtedly make me rich and famous and deliver me the attention I've missed this year while massively annoying the mothers of the many children I will have in order to better understand the predicament I am in during this lonely time. Although the 3 months were endless, once I got through them and into the other 9, they turned out to be the highlight. The rest of the year spent back in normality and regular company was kind of uneventful compared to the cloistered period where I knew I was the very center of my self-created mental universe, a feature of my existence that the undying 6-year-old part of my psyche will deign to make true forever. And as much as we little boys can be cute and hilarious, at the drop of a hat we can turn and be vicious and cruel too. And I quite like letting that fixed forevermore part of my dark side play out, because letting it play out delivers such easily energetic kicks, like the ones refused for so much of this year, caged with Charlie Boy in the house.